Recording?
Yeah, recording.
Recording.
This is Mom's Basement Podcast, episode 24.
Yep.
Wow, did you ever think we'd make it to 24?
Nope.
No, not a chance.
Didn't see that coming.
Before we get started, we had someone make a recommendation that I think was a good one, which was that we introduce ourselves at the top of the podcast.
Yeah.
This is a kind of natural, smart thing to do that our totally unprofessional podcast overlooked.
Yep.
So I'm William, also Hank. It's ambiguous.
Mm. Yep. I'm Rudy.
Rudy with fries in his mouth.
Mm.
And I'm Mike.
Okay. We're going to have a few discussions today.
A few good ones. Mm-hmm. Sexual.
One thing we are going to do is we are going to begin a new series.
Yeah.
A couple of weeks ago, while we were on hiatus because I was in a different state and then ended up in another state and then finally got home, we put out a call on the blog, bringing your games into the basement. This was based on another offer, Sage Reads Games.
Right.
Which all came from a discussion about how to encourage people who have games in development, as we all do, to finish them. How can the community support games in development?
Yeah.
So our offer was simple. Email us your game. We will playtest it. We will send you a recorded copy of that playtest, as abysmal as it might be, and the Emperor Black one was a real mess.
Yeah.
And then we will discuss it on podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And so we already have five games on our list. We've had five different people request that their games be covered on podcasts. And the first one was Deathbird Black, which was a Ronnie entry, which we talked about in last episode.
Yep.
So we play-tested it, and later we're going to return to it and talk about it some more.
Yep.
And now I have a mouthful of chicken. Okay.
Chicken.
But first,
yeah, first chicken.
Wow. First I choked.
We're all eating on something right now, so
yeah.
Bear with us as we recover.
First, though, someone here gets a round of applause or congrats. Rudy, your game has been accepted to be published, right?
Well,
in a way.
Sort of.
You want to talk about that?
Well, Ryan Macklin and John Walton are doing a publication called Magic Missile.
And what is this publication?
And it's basically a collection of games, game-related articles, that kind of thing.
Especially quick play games, right?
Quick play games, yeah. That are going to be played at Go Play Northwest, I think.
Oh, nice.
Yep. And so I submitted a long time ago a proposal for my game Student Zombie, which is a sort of quick play game, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think so.
And my proposal was accepted. It hasn't been accepted for publication yet because I still have to send the draft and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
But your proposal's been accepted.
Mm.
Well, that's a step in the right direction. So you may see one of your games in something resembling a published form by, what, July?
July, yes.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that would be pretty nice.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah. Be pretty sexy.
Definitely. And Student Zombie is an awesome game. It's very similar to your game Death's Head, which
won the
Ronnie.
Yes.
In the January round. Okay. Now, I want to do a little bit of topical discussion here. I realized I didn't check what time it was when we got started, but I've got a general idea.
Yeah, it was like 10 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Get that.
So, one topic that has been snowballing for the past couple of weeks while we've been on hiatus is the issue of the value of playtesting. Mm. Ben Lehman wrote an article on Vincent Baker's blog called Playtesting, Stop. And it really wasn't quite as simple as that. It wasn't just don't ever playtest, but basically his point was a lot of the time when people are playtesting, they're doing it for the wrong reasons and they're doing it in the wrong way. Mm. So I thought maybe we'd have a discussion about the value of playtesting when we think it's appropriate, when we think it's not appropriate.
Mm. That's fair. I mean, jeez.
Today is the day that every member of the podcast chokes while they try to eat and talk at the same time.
Yeah, brilliant.
Except for Rudy, who's gingerly picking sesame seeds off of his bun.
McDonald's.
Well, let me try and think this, how I'm going to say this.
I think playtesting is basically always appropriate.
Always, really?
I don't think, I think if you're doing it with the intention of refining a design that you have a clear idea of, that you should do it.
You don't think that playtesting is ever a bad idea? You don't think you can playtest at the wrong time and for the wrong reason?
I can't see what a wrong reason for playtesting would be.
Well, here's one thing I want to add in. I have one question as part of the stipulation. When you playtest, are you being involved in your own playtest?
That's a good point.
I mean, it could be either, obviously.
Yeah. Because if you are, do not playtest. You're too close to the project. You need out. The idea of playtesting is to refine it, correct? Mm-hmm. But if you're inside of it and trying to guide it a certain way, it's going to be seen differently.
Mm. That's sort of true, I think.
I think
both types of playtesting are important. The type where, external playtesting, where you have groups that don't know you and don't know your style and that stuff.
The whole point of an author creating a game for people is that they want it to go a certain way, and that's but if you're getting something, if the playgroup should be able to get whatever they want out of it, that's my thing.
That's a good point.
Without the author's interference too much.
And that's actually a point that, to some degree, I think Ben Lehman made. I don't want to distort what he was saying here, but I think one of his points is kind of similar to yours in that the author's presence in play can have disturbing effect. I mean, what you're sort of talking about, Mike, really is groupthink. The idea that being too close to what's going on, being too enmeshed in your own personal playgroup, is going to lead everyone involved to have it's going to skew the expectations of everyone involved.
Yeah.
And I think that's true. I would say that earlier we said, he didn't think there was ever a bad reason to playtest. I think there's such a thing as playtesting as procrastination.
Yeah, there is probably that.
Which is to say,
like, you don't really know where to go with a game.
Right. And you so playtest it.
Yeah.
As a result. And I think that can be a bad kind of playtesting because it can lead to unnecessary refinements. And I'm making air quotes here just to be obnoxious. False refinements in a game that is finished or high quality anyway, and it may just lead to you being dragged around by the group because you feel like this still needs to be refined.
That's
because
true.
You feel like there's still something wrong with the game, and you can create an endless cycle of revision and revision and revision.
Yeah, that's the exact opposite. Well,
that's why
of what
you need external playtesting
as an escape from publication.
That's why you need external playtesting.
You need a mix of, a little bit of both.
And
you do need to observe first person, a little bit. I think that's okay. But having external groups playtest is very important, I think.
Yeah.
Because that's going to be like 90% of your audience anyway.
Yeah.
That's true. And, I heard something suggested a few times, and this isn't coming from me, but it's something that really rung true to me, and I think Rudy is going to disagree with me on this, maybe, and Mike might as well. But one thing, as I said, that I've heard is that there are two and only two people you present your game to for the purpose of playtesting or revision, or two and only two groups of people. Yeah. One is a group of people close to you whose opinions you legitimately trust, who you understand how they play, you agree with how they play, and you understand their perspective, and you know that they are going to give you valuable feedback.
Right.
The other group you present your game to are people who don't play role-playing games, who don't have the dialogue. And the reason you present it to them is so that they will tell you from a complete outsider perspective whether or not they can understand the text, what jumps out at them in the text, and whether or not they could pick up this game and play it, having not played RPGs before, or having rarely played RPGs before.
Right.
And I think that that's definitely what I would want to do if I was preparing a game for publication, and I am preparing a couple, hopefully, is I would want to, first of all, present it to the two people who are at the table with me, get their opinions, and then show it to some people who don't play RPGs or rarely play RPGs. Maybe Diana, maybe Lee, someone like that. Yeah. People whose intelligence I respect, but who are definitely not RPG players, and say, can you understand this? Would you be able to play this? Would you want to play this as a person who doesn't generally play RPGs?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. As long as they're willing to accept the premise of an RPG.
Right. As long as they're not totally anti-RPG.
Yeah.
I know some people like that.
But the audience I really wouldn't want to agonize over, the audience I really wouldn't want to throw my game at too much before I was ready to publish it, would be the people who are between those two groups. The people who are who play a lot of RPGs, but who I don't know well enough personally to understand where their criticism would be coming from. Certainly if someone wants to take one of my games and look at it and offer me feedback, that's great, that's fantastic, I'll take it. But I am not going to give too much weight to that when it comes, when revision comes around, you know? Or I'm going to be looking at that from a very particular, cautious perspective.
Yeah, I get that.
I think you need all three of those to make a decent game.
See, I'm okay with the in-between group and getting feedback from them. I agree that you probably shouldn't change it for every little thing.
Right.
If you get a lot of the same complaint, though,
then
okay.
That's the thing.
As long as it's a lot of the same complaint.
Yeah. I think the thing with indie RPGs, though, is your pool of playtesters is often so limited that you're not going to have... You're not going to be able to repeat the process enough times to really get that many reoccurring, you know, points. Unless it's something really glaring.
Yeah, and there is a point to that also, where if you end up making a lot of games and you keep showing it to the same audience, they might start to understand how you actually write and have a better understanding, in air quotes, A, obnoxiousness, B, and not really give you exactly what you're looking for in feedback, because they know you so well.
You think that'd be the case, that knowing you so well... I mean, obviously, if they're playing games with you a lot, I guess the group thing comes into play again, where you've developed a certain perspective, and you become so anchored by that perspective. That perspective becomes RPGs to you, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And then you could have a problem, which is why I definitely show it, too, to people who... don't play RPGs at all.
And here's my thinking on what I just said. If they get so used to it, they might have expectations of what to expect from your next creation.
Oh, I
and
see.
That's true.
I see. So if you tried to make a game that was a radical departure from what you did before, then they might diss the game just because it's a radical departure from their expectations.
Possibly.
So, like, if I were to introduce the game to this group that I had proposed for the February Ronnies but never made, which was a nostalgic car trip game, this group might be like, what the fuck is that? Like, where's the, either the, you know, the making fun of fantasy aspect, or where's the, you know, I don't know how to say it any except to say nastiness aspect. Where's the nastiness?
Yeah, and that's where it goes back to your thing where you only have the two groups.
Right.
Right.
That's just,
you don't want that middle group seeing that.
That's true.
But that's just my thoughts on it. Maybe maybe I'm full of bullshit.
No, I think that's a good point. I think that you definitely need some kind of outside group. It can't just be the inner circle assessing your game.
No.
Unless you're creating your game just for the inner circle, you know?
Right, of course.
And I'm not... I mean, I do think, though, you have to be very careful when you get feedback from playtesting, though.
Yeah.
You have to be very confident in what you want out of your design.
Exactly. That's what I said in the beginning. Only if you know what you want to get out of your design.
Right.
Although, I would make one other point here. Don't make a change after the first playtest. Wait 3.
Yeah.
Wait at least 3.
At least 3.
Yeah.
Unless what you saw was really glaring.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
It was like a lapse in... the kind of lapse in judgment you can make when you're really engrossed in creating something that becomes blaringly obvious as soon as you see it in play.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I
mean, this maybe goes... Writing an RPG game for an audience is a lot like being an actual fiction author.
Yeah.
In this sense.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think in that case, you really have to do the same thing. I think it's even more important that you only listen to those two groups if you're writing fiction. Because you can get so much better. And I have written stuff and put it up on writing forums or whatever, thinking I was going to get good feedback and that this would help me build confidence. No, it's the opposite. People give you terrible feedback. Yeah. And it's like, did you even read the story? Did you make any attempt to figure out where I was coming from before you said this? Mm. And it's never the stuff you hope to get.
Mm.
You know, it's never, I see what you're doing there, but this is how you need to refine it. Mm. This is what, and sometimes you get that, rarely, but most of these writing forums are kind of feedback mills where you give feedback just so the guy will come and give you feedback. Mm-hmm. So you give as many people feedback as quickly as possible.
And if I can make an aside here, this all started from a very bad loop in college where people were taught, hey, this is how it's supposed to be, an arbitrary ruling from one teacher. Mm-hmm. An aside.
Yeah, exactly. That
that's true.
There's another rule at work here. Which, it's hard for me to say this without sounding like a dick, but the reality is, when you're reading a piece of fiction, any piece of fiction that is written, any piece of fiction that's dumber than you is accessible, and the closer it gets to your level of intelligence, the smarter it gets. Farther it gets past your level of intelligence, the more pretentious it becomes, as far as their perspective is concerned.
Much.
And I think that that's sad. And I think the same is true in a different way of RPGs, which is that we don't want to cultivate a feedback mill kind of playtesting ethos, where it's like, playtest my game and I'll playtest yours.
Yeah.
And, you know, you play it for an hour and then you give a quick write-up.
Right.
And then you tally points based on how many times your game has been playtested. And once you have 75 points or whatever, it's time to publish.
Right.
I mean, that is clearly a very bad, nasty kind of playtesting.
Mm. Yeah.
And that needs to be avoided, I think. And I think if that's the kind of playtesting that Ben Lehman was hoping to discourage, and I did read his article, but I read it like 2 weeks ago, so I don't want to speak too confidently on what he was trying to say. But if that's the type of feedback, that feedback mill perspective is what he's trying to discourage, then absolutely.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Now, one other thing I wanted to talk about before I get to... before we get to Deathbird Black. Well, first of all, did you guys have any topics you wanted to
Nothing for me.
Not really, no.
I wanted to talk a little bit about a game that we discussed on the last podcast, which has since spawned a kind of awesome controversy.
Oh, yeah.
And that game is The Secret Lives of Serial Killers.
Ah, yes.
That was a pretty awesome game.
Now, this game got pretty enthusiastic support from us last time, actually. Mm,
yeah. I mean, it wasn't one of my favorites, but eh.
Right. It wasn't on Mike's list. Sorry, I'm searching for something. It wasn't on Mike's list, but it was on Rudy's list and my list. What?
Take the hand away from the mouth. It's covering.
Oh, is it preventing you from...
It's preventing the camera from hearing you.
Really?
I guarantee it.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry. Okay. So anyway, it's a game that Rudy and I like very much. Mike, less so? What was your complaint?
It wasn't that it was a complaint. There wasn't really a complaint about it. It was... You lost... I believe this was the one where you had the two different game views, like the secret game view for the outside player, and then everyone else was playing the killer, right?
Right.
Yeah. This one... A, it leaves out whoever read it from playing it properly.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was actually the complaint that you made.
Yeah, and the other thing is, it just... That was one of those, it just isn't my game sort of thing, anyway. Because you have to come up with a new victim each time, technically.
Yeah. It's not really something that's made to be played multiple times. And perhaps not made to be played at all, as Willow suggested within the game text.
Yeah. Oh, no, this is made to be played by psychologists.
Yeah.
That's true.
Psychologists will play this game.
Stanley Milgram presents. But anyway, what happened was a fight broke out. Willow herself was really not deeply involved in the fight, but the fight broke out between Ron Edwards and Callan about whether or not...
Callan, my man.
Whether or not this game should exist at all, whether or not it's fit to exist, whether or not it's such a nasty, ugly example of game design that it shouldn't be rewarded at all. And, it says you have two individuals who are known to stunt, to use the G-Unit terminology. This, of course, got very, very out of hand. And it led to Callan...
Yeah, they did stunt.
Proposing a hypothetical RPG based on The Secret Lives of Serial Killers, which he would call The Secret Lives of Role Players, in which you invite a female player to the game.
Oh.
Yeah, it gets...
You present her with a hypothetical RPG where she plays, you know, the date of a male player. The male player spends the first part of the game acting very romantic, you know, whining and dining, and very polite, and the idea is that this is some kind of, you know, Emily Carboss dating sim RPG. And then near the end of the game, the male player suddenly reaches out and grabs her breast, the female player's breast.
First of all, let me just say, I think that game is fucking awesome.
I do not agree with that assessment in any way whatsoever. But I do not support that idea, but that's why it's a fictitious game, a hypothetical.
Right. And I just want to read the way Callan puts it in the post, and this is what I was searching for when I
this
was
is
mumbling. Because just the way he words it.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Quoting now. I have this convoluted example I was going to use before, but didn't for convolutedness. In it, I was going to have an RPG, perhaps around a theme of some inhumanly, gentlemanly guy romancing a lady, a la Mills and Boone or Twilight. But here's the fun twist, You invite a female player, and later in the game, you actually touch her on her real-life boobs. Just out of the blue. It's a rule that you have to. Ha! She totally thought it was romance, but here you are, hand on boob. Kapow! Gut punch!
Yep.
And...
which side is he arguing for?
He's arguing for...
For bullshit. Said, yeah, that's okay.
I mean, his argument is that the secret lives of serial killers, the kind of emotional... because gut punch was the word that I believe Ron... or the phrase that Ron Edwards used to describe, you know, the visceral impact of the secret lives of serial killers. And Callan's basically saying, no, this game is reprehensible. And this is a paralleling example to prove how reprehensible it is.
I don't think it's a fair comparison necessarily.
I was going to say that. I don't think it's a particularly fair comparison.
No, I don't think it's fair. But...
because I think... now, you could say what you want about the secret lives of serial killers being a breach of the generally accepted rules of role-playing etiquette.
No, oh, it's a breach of the social contract.
Right.
Yeah,
the
it
social
is.
Contract. But it's not... It's not a breach of law.
Can I make a simile or an analogy here?
Right.
Secret Lives of Serial Killers is what a jump-in is to get into a game. That's my feeling.
No, that's a good point. Yeah.
That's what it is. That's all
it's
it is.
Hazing.
Yeah. Yes, it
You're
is.
You're saying it's role-playing hazing.
Yeah. Right. It which, totally is.
And the person in some ways... maybe submitting to being hazed by the secret lives of serial killers just by agreeing...
by showing up there.
Showing up to play a game that they're not really... yeah. Without properly being debriefed. Or just generally by wanting to join the social circle of role players. They open themselves up for this kind of...
yeah.
It's a little more accurate that way, too, the more I think about that. Because it's sort of like the group already is this sort of fraternity in a way. And you're getting... sort of, you know, hazed into this thing.
Right. Well, and I mean, some role-playing groups are like fraternities, and they are very insular, and they are very adolescent in a way.
Yeah.
And that makes sense as an approach.
Yeah.
Whether or not the secret lives of serial killers would be seen as the support of that kind of role-playing fraternity mindset, or a kind of critique or satire of it, I don't know.
But yeah, I don't know where it fits in there, but it certainly seems to.
I do think Callan is getting at something, though, honestly. I don't think, as I said, there's a difference between something that's a breach of the sexual contract. Okay.
That thing is nasty.
Of the social contract and an instance of, you know, sexual assault that could result in...
going to jail.
Yeah, or probation, or at least talking to a judge, ordering
and
something, rather.
And forever being listed on your state's goddamn website as a sex offender.
But imagine for a second, I have a different parallel hypothetical example. Imagine that instead of it being called The Secret Lives of Serial Killers, this was The Secret Lives of Serial Rapists.
Of sex offenders.
Right.
Yeah.
The game proceeds the same way.
Yeah.
You reach the twist, except at the twist, instead of being tortured and murdered,
you're raped.
In role playing, you are raped.
Yeah.
And all the same conditions apply. Yeah. The victim player is still powerless to dictate the circumstances. The rape is still narrated, obviously. It's not an actual rape, but it's a narrative rape.
Yeah, it's a facsimile.
The player who would be playing the serial killer describes a rape in graphic detail in the same way that he would be describing the killing in The Secret Lives of Serial Killers. Mm. How do you think people would respond to that game? Do you think that anyone would be on the forge saying, this is a cool idea?
On the forge, I think so.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe a few on the forge, but outside of the forge, that thing would get shot down fairly quickly.
Yeah. Well... and I wonder, what does that say?
Yeah.
Does that say simply that we think that rape is somehow a more objectionable crime than murder?
Yeah.
Absolutely in that case. Or because yeah, we sort of romanticize murder in some ways.
Yeah. Right.
But we as a society do not romanticize, right?
Yeah.
But certainly the experiences are equally traumatic, especially in the kind of situation being described here, which is to say that to be held down and tortured and killed is probably going to be approximately as traumatic as being held down and raped.
Yeah.
Now,
you could argue that...
Uh-oh, do you really want to go there?
Well,
I think we might have just opened our mouths to my
head. Yeah.
Do you really want to go there, man?
I mean, you could say that there's a real distinction, right, between... Yeah. The kind of torture that you have to undergo as a victim of rape and, say, being the murderer, being the victim of a quick drive-by killing, you know?
Well,
you could say, well, maybe rape is more horrific than having the lights just suddenly go out.
Yeah,
you can easily make that argument.
In the hospital.
Because you're living with the trauma still of the actual rape versus you're dead and can't live with the trauma of the torture.
And you could argue that, well, maybe... role-playing a rape sequence in detail towards an unwilling player is more reprehensible than role-playing a sequence where a player is, you know, quickly dispatched. And of course, you wouldn't have role-playing games if you didn't have moments when player characters were quickly dispatched against their will.
That's
true. Go back to the original D&D, you know,
you
stepped on the wrong tile, Spike comes up through the floor and impales you, it's over.
Yeah.
But to say that, but in this imagined parallel, you have to wonder about the reprehensibleness, or lack thereof, of an extensive scene detailing the torture and murder of an unwilling player in character.
Yeah.
And how if we just change it to a slightly different
violent crime? Yeah. I think that says something more about the crime and its perception than
it does about the secret lives of serial killers in the game.
Yeah.
It's possible. It may have more to do with the way our culture looks at rape versus murder.
Yeah.
I mean, very much so. I mean, there are games, whole video games, PC games that are wholly centered around killing each other in pretty horrific ways.
But then rape play comes out, and they're like, fuck them.
Yeah.
Once the rape comes down, it's done.
Yep. Banned.
So I don't know. I mean, honestly, if I was made the victim in either of those games, I probably wouldn't care too much. I'd get kind of flustered at the time. I'd be like, what the fuck just happened?
Can I add some context?
Yeah.
I think in more than one instance, both of you were willing to be rape victims.
Well,
in multiple games.
Yeah.
Oh, that's true.
That's true. It's
maybe not in horrific detail, though,
right,
which is the key here.
Right. So, I don't know. I mean, I think we've passed the event horizon of terrible role-playing, of morally reprehensible role-playing, to the point that maybe we can't see.
I don't know if that's necessarily true, but maybe you got something there.
I don't know. I just... See, the thing is, when I read The Secret Lives of Serial Killers, I didn't think... It wasn't my initial reaction, like, oh my god, how terrible this is.
Yeah.
You know, it was...
That
my
wasn't
initial
my
reaction was, boy, I bet I could really piss some dude off with this.
Yeah.
And that would be kind of hilarious.
Yeah.
But I didn't think of it as an instrument of emotional damage, you know, of emotional violence.
Hmm. Same here.
I did not
think of it that way either. Hmm.
Anyway.
I wonder how much the author did, considering the similar Geek Forum games that
exist. Do you think that maybe Willow was trying to take a stab at Geek Forum games?
Oh, no, but I mean, I wonder just what she thought about that kind of...
Well, Willow, if you're listening to this and would like to let us know.
Yeah.
But...
Jump on.
While we're talking about the event horizon of morally reprehensible role-playing, Time to talk about Deathbird Black.
Yep.
Not morally reprehensible at all.
Not really.
No, not really. Good fun.
Yeah, really fun game.
Now, if you're listening and you haven't read Deathbird Black, it might be a good idea to, you know, skim the manual.
Yep. Yeah,
so that you can understand what we're talking about. A link podcast. Will be in the blog entry for this podcast.
Can you hand me my sheet, Rudy? It should be right in front of you.
Oh, this one, yep.
Okay, just to summarize briefly, Deathbird Black is a game of comedy noir.
Yep.
It's a game where you play gritty noir heroes doing ridiculous things, and you try to make each other laugh, and you throw dice in a pit, and you have fun.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
I had a lot of fun playing it.
Yeah, I had serious fun playing it.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I got into it maybe a bit more than I should have.
It definitely accomplishes what it sets out to do, which is I would have a lot of trouble imagining someone who plays RPGs sitting down with this game and not just having a fun time.
Mm. Yeah.
Because there's really something for everyone here. If you're a dice chucker, you get to literally chuck the dice. If you're a role-playing excess guy, you get to ham it up as much as you fucking want to.
Yep.
To whatever ridiculous extremes you want. And it's a no-judge situation, because you can't be like, well, that's not realistic. It's like, no, this is supposed to be absurd.
Hmm.
Yeah. I mean, unless you're someone who believes, you know, gaming is serious, period.
Serious business.
But I think that, I don't know if that person exists.
No. Oh, no, I'm sure it does. Yeah, maybe. It's very rare.
Yeah.
Some things that worked, before we get into our critiques, what are some things that you definitely thought worked with the game?
The GM stance seemed to work pretty well. You're not asked to do too much or too little.
Yeah,
that's true. The GM was always actively involved in the game, was never never dominated the game.
Right. Let me think what else worked here.
Caw!
Yeah, Mephistopheles. That was awesome.
The Deathbird moments themselves are suitably hectic.
Really. Yeah, they were frantic.
Like, frantic, good.
Yeah. One quick correction. Ours was named Jim Crow.
Yes.
Ours was named Jim Crow, indeed. Jim Crow.
Which in some ways was the least racist moment of the playtest.
The podcast. Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah, I think the get up and everyone yell out what you're going to do to the Deathbird at once moment really worked. Throwing the dice at the tub really worked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was fun.
Yeah.
The character creation, if it was meant to be a clusterfuck, goal accomplished!
Yeah.
I like character creation. The random generation by cards, really like that.
Yes, I like
that. You get
that
a quick
too.
Archetype.
I like that.
And you get a quick flaw.
And you don't have to sit there waiting 3 hours for somebody to think of something.
Yeah,
that?
And this game is meant to be picked up and played quickly,
so
that's definitely good. One thing I would have liked to have seen in character generation was a more extensive chart with 52 options, so that each unique combination of suit and number had a archetype and a flaw.
Yeah, yeah, like exactly. The 10 of spades is different from the 10 of clubs, is different from the 10 of diamonds, etc.
Right. So that would offer more extensive options, because I know that even just playing it the one session that we played, we started to get duplicates.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I don't think, what is it, 13 options for each one is really quite enough. And I know this is an alpha build, and it was originally written in half an hour. But if this is going to be polished to be made a full game, I'd like to see a full chart that lets you use the entire deck of cards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at least 26. One for red, one for black.
Right.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, that's a possibility, too.
Yeah, that could be.
At minimum that much, because I can see why you might run out at 52. But 26 is necessary.
Flaws and complications and what they mean and how they come into play. Murky in the manual.
Very,
had a lot of trouble really puzzling this out. And those were the only time that the game really stopped dead was when we were trying to figure out exactly what a flaw was. Did it have to be linked to another player?
Yeah.
And what a complication was? Did it have to be linked to a different player?
Right.
Yeah.
There was some ambiguity there.
Yeah, that's what I meant by it was a clusterfuck. Because it was suggested that you go right one way, left the other, and it just became a real mess there for a moment or two.
And exactly what your relationship was supposed to be with the other players and how they were supposed to help you was very ambiguous.
Yeah.
So that's something I would have liked to have seen cleaned up.
Yeah.
Any thoughts, Rudy? On character creation?
Not on character creation, no.
How about on general body of play, the midsection of play?
I think the score mechanic was a little weird, I thought, because, I don't know, like, somebody had said, like, if you're the GM, you don't really get to score.
Yeah.
So it sort of sets you back.
Right. And
yeah, dying is a big hindrance on the score. Oh, yeah, Mecca, go ahead.
Yeah, but, I guess we only did two rounds of it, so I think it's anticipated that everybody's going to get to be the GM once.
Now,
so.
Two rounds took about 3 hours.
So maybe I think it runs a little longish,
depending on who's playing. I think that the better solution to this, and assuming that everyone is going to be GM in one setting,
because
if you don't die, if your character never dies, you never get to be GM.
Right.
So it might not rotate to you. Would be just to give the GM maybe some ways to earn points?
Yeah, that's a good solution.
Maybe the players can give the GM points under certain circumstances.
Yeah.
Just so that the GM can earn a score when he's playing, so that he's not going to be behind.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
The actual... Also, I don't think there's enough opportunities for you to really earn points during the play.
I think it's
very hard, especially if you have 2d6s. You're pretty much not going to complete your goal unless you get so lucky.
I mean, at most, you get 3 points per round.
Right. Well, you could hypothetically, I guess, generate a new goal after you get your first one, maybe, while still in the same round.
It didn't seem that way when I was reading it as the GM, because it said you're supposed to make up your... Think about your next goal or something for the next time or something?
I don't know. That may need to be clarified.
Yeah,
but
that probably would.
They're really... The odds that you're able to get, you know, your flaw, at either your flaw or your complication totally out of the way and have a plan to deal with the other and nail your role in order to complete your goal. I mean, if you've got 2d10s, you might do it once. If you've got 2d8s, you have a chance to do it once, and you have 2d6s, you're almost definitely not going to do it.
Yeah.
So, if we're talking about game balance, and I'm not sure if game balance is that essential to a game like this.
No, it's not.
But you really don't get that many opportunities for points. And if you are either really good at throwing the dice in the pit, or really lucky, when throwing your dice in your pit, you can really rack up a score, since you can get up to two every time you sink every time you have an opportunity to throw dice in the pit. You can get up to 2 points, versus usually around 1 point per scene.
Right.
So, sinking the dice gives you more points faster.
Yeah,
and
really.
If you sink all of your dice, it guarantees that you are coming back next time, not as a GM, meaning
you're
going to get more opportunities.
You're
going to
get more, so it sort of snowballs.
And then it guarantees you'll be alive at the end of the game to get a final scene, which could potentially earn you another point.
Two things to keep in mind for our audience here, though. One, we used a group of 4 people with 3 players and 1 GM.
Yes, right.
Secondly, the distance of the bucket from where we were, not necessarily at recommended distance, but that's because of the room we played in.
Right, not equal for everyone.
Yeah.
And Tom, who was also playing, had trouble sinking his dice, but he was also the furthest away from the pit.
Right.
And he didn't get up to equalize it.
Right.
So, That could be an issue. Speaking of Scar, let's talk about what's kind of the most controversial mechanic here. Well, there were two mechanics that were controversial in the first discussion. One being the laughter mechanic, and the other being the endgame vote on who wins mechanic. Let's talk about the laughter one first, because I think that'll be quick.
See, I love the laughter mechanic.
I really enjoyed the laughter mechanic.
I don't see what's so controversial about it. What was their complaint?
Yeah.
Basically, any type of system that awards points based on subjective things like player emotional response don't work, or are generally considered not to be workable. And people were saying, this was on the forge once again in the feedback thread for this game, that they had played other games with laughter mechanics, and that they hadn't been very effective, that they had derailed the game in some way, or at least prevented the game from really working. But the laughter mechanics they were talking about were games where you... the point was to laugh, rather than to not laugh. So it was games where you had to try to get each other to laugh. One was a someone mentioned was a comedy game where the scene didn't end until you made someone laugh.
So
then everyone gets self-conscious about laughing.
Right, exactly.
You know, it's like, oh, I should be laughing, or, oh, that person expects me to laugh because they think they were just funny.
Right.
And that leads to social awkwardness.
Right.
Whereas I think mechanics where you're asked not to laugh, where it's like, don't laugh.
Don't laugh at that.
Are better, because...
Right.
If you don't laugh at something, it doesn't necessarily mean it wasn't funny and the person should feel bad. It's because you're trying not to laugh.
Right.
Whereas if you do laugh, the player who made you laugh gets the satisfaction because they got through to you. And you, even though you're in some ways penalized, although there's no real penalty for laughing in this, even though you gave in, still feel good because you just laughed.
Yeah.
And I think that's very different than a game that's like, make someone laugh. Why are you not laughing? And I don't know. We've used laughter mechanics in games before and always enjoyed it. And they were a blast here. The thing, in this instance, they were almost too easy because we didn't have any scene cycle where the GM didn't give each player their second die by laughing.
It was easy. And maybe this may be just my experience on it, but maybe this is exactly right where the GM can earn points. For not laughing.
There could be a way to do that.
Because there's no incentive for him to not laugh, other than self-pressure.
That's true, yeah.
Maybe if all the other players laugh at a joke, but you don't get a point.
That's a good point.
Or something like that. Or, like, if all the players... If you laughed at none of the players there, you get, like, 2 or 3 points.
Oh, okay, so if...
I see.
If you make it to the end of the session, you get 1 point for each player who you didn't give a second die.
Or, well, so whatever would allow the same match for all the players, because the match is, like, 3 points or so. So 3 points at the end is the match.
So that would be it. If you didn't laugh at all, you could get 3 points.
That's a possibility. That would be cool.
I like that.
It's just an idea, though.
So. No, I like that. I think that's a good idea. The other endgame mechanic I can't endorse as wholeheartedly. At the end of the game, take your score, and then that score doesn't mean you won. That score is votes that you have to cast towards another player winning based on who created the most memorable moment.
We had one person with 6 votes. I was in second place with 2.
Right. At the end, first of all, at the end of the game, as you said, the score was all over the place. And there was nothing in the game mechanics about splitting your votes. So I had 6 points to give away, and under the rules as written, I would have to give all of them to one person, as opposed to maybe giving 2 to each other player. So that's kind of dicey. But I think more dicey than that is the concept itself. I don't think it works. I don't think it's something that historically has worked in games, and I don't think it's something that's necessary in this game. Yeah. And I voiced this concern when we were critiquing the game initially. And I withheld judgment and I backed away from my judgment and saw how it turned out in playtest. And it was pretty much like I expected, which is to say that it was almost a solemn moment. It was almost somber, you know, yeah. And it was awkward. Because it's like, well, who do I want to validate?
Right.
And I don't think, in a game that's this goofy and off the wall in general, I don't think you really want that kind of gold star moment.
Yeah,
I agree.
Yeah.
And I felt that the impetus was actually, I know on my part, to give, not to think too seriously about it, not to really try to figure out, well, who contributed the most, who made the most memorable moment, but instead to find a way to cleverly hand it off based on some joke, you know?
Right.
So, you know, make the handing of the points, not to say handing the points to the person who I thought made the best joke, but to make distributing the points itself a joke.
Right.
As opposed to really trying to assess it. Because if you try to assess it, first of all, you're sitting there thinking, everyone at this table made me laugh. I had fun with everyone. And then you're just splitting hairs. And it becomes almost personal.
Yeah.
See, I think I have something here to go solutions-oriented tonight in this. Because this is a really whose line is it anyway sort of game in a way. What if instead of having it be like, because the points voting thing is definitely arbitrary. You don't really need the voting thing at the end.
You don't.
But what if, like, group declares winner, winner gets bonus scene at end? Because it is going to be arbitrary about most memorable moment anyway.
Right.
I mean, I think you still have the issue, though, that you have that moment when the game actually slows down and you lose some of the fun of it because people are making an assessment of how other people played the game.
Yeah,
well, it shouldn't be slowed down. It should be gut reaction. If you can't come up with something within, like, 15 seconds, nobody gets a
point.
I think that's fair in that sense.
I would say, I mean, there's a legitimate argument to be made that maybe the score system isn't the best way to decide a winner.
Yeah.
You know, because maybe the score system isn't perfectly mechanically balanced.
Right.
But I would say, first of all, shouldn't be a game where people walk away saying, I won that, and gloating, because you know that the things you did to win it were mostly arbitrary, and it was just about the fun you had at the table.
Right.
And maybe if you had the person who had the highest score get something like Mike said, and I'm talking about the highest score, not any of the voting stuff, get a special scene. But maybe if that scene was, if they tried to frame that scene personally as a kind of glorious ending for them.
And
the other players did everything they could to undermine that scene and make it goofy and funny.
Yeah.
So then you have the faux winner. You know, the guy pumps himself up and, I won this game, and everyone else is just poking fun at the arbitrariness.
Right. See, that could be actually kind of in the spirit of the game.
Right. So they try to do their serious noir ending where they're big and bad, and the other people are going, caw, caw, or they're just moving around, or they're, you know, whatever.
Yeah. That could perfect.
Be, that could be cool, actually.
And I think you don't have that moment of, oh, I have to, like, pick a dude to win.
Yeah,
it's already right there, most points.
And you also don't have a winning, a victory that means too much.
Right.
That is,
it's just another opportunity to have more fun.
Right. So I think that pretty much sums up what I thought. Anyone else have final thoughts here?
Yeah, I think I've said enough.
Death, Bird, Cloud,
personally. No, I guess pretty much. Did we already cover the part about one person scoring too much, I think?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So, yeah, that's pretty much it.
So, Vaxel, if you're listening to this, first of all, some apologies about the quality of the playtest.
It will be terrible, just like this podcast.
Just like most. That's about the quality of our normal podcast, though.
So. Yeah, that's true.
Willing Hopefully to take donation of an actual microphone?
Yeah.
That's
Hopefully we didn't offend you.
Yep.
That wasn't our only aim.
Yeah.
And if anyone else has thoughts on Death Bird Black, make a comment.
Yep.
And if anyone wants to bring their game into the basement and get a horrible recording, low quality recording of a ridiculous, terrible actual play,
yep,
and 30 minutes or so of critique on the real podcast, send that to send your game, a PDF of your game, and whatever details you think we should have, to momsbasementpodcast@gmail.com, and we will get right back to you. All right?
Roger, that's...
So, roger, roger.
Roger, roger.
That's that.
That's Mom's Basement Podcast.
Mom's
Episode
Basement.
Episode 24?
24, is next 25? Time. No, this is 24.
Shit.
Why?
Oh, no, I was just thinking. I thought we were on 25, but...
No, next time, I believe.
Yeah.
Figuring it out real fast. This is 24. Next time is our 25th episode,
yep,
spectacular, in which we'll do nothing
spectacular. This will be as shitty as Craig Ferguson's Late Night Show if you watch it.
Oh, poor Craig Ferguson.
Oh, no, he says it's crap.
Oh, I love his show.
I do too.
I sometimes watch The Daily Show. That's about it.
I honestly, I don't give a fuck about...
But yes, this is episode 24.
Next time we will be discussing Stefloid's game, Ingeniero.
Oh, yes.
So tune in then.
Callahan, if you're listening, I love you, have my babies.